I want to consider with you the familiar text, but often misunderstood text, of Romans chapter 8 and its verse 28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to his purpose, which, following more closely the order of the words that Paul actually wrote, I believe should be translated more accurately as, but we know that to those who love God, he works all things together for good, to those who are called according to his purpose. Well, it's only going to take us a few moments to get our bearings in the passage. The whole closing section of the chapter, Romans 8, from verse 17 right through to the end, 39, it was written to encourage, sustain the saints at Rome in the face of suffering. And to do that by lifting their eyes to the certainty of a coming glory. Glory of all proportion to anything which the powers of this world or the powers of darkness could conceivably throw at them. A prospect so glorious indeed that the whole of creation could be said to stand on tiptoe, sighing for the time when it was to have a share in that glory. Verses 18 through 27 speak of three forms of groaning or sighing: that of the creation, that of the believer, and that of the Holy Spirit. And the section more or less closes with Paul's expression in verse 26. We do not know what to pray for as we ought. And it would be very hard to miss that the opening words of our text for this evening stand in deliberate contrast to that acknowledgement. But we know, and I'm satisfied that but is the correct translation, but we know. I've no doubt each of us find, and find far too often, that as the apostle says, we do not know what to pray for. But over against this, the man insists, using the very same word translated know, which he didn't have to, we do know. Something of immense and heartwarming significance and importance, namely that to those who love God, he works all things together for good. Now the apostle here characterizes believers as those who love God, the description which he'd used twice in an earlier letter, the one first that we have to the Corinthians, and which James used twice in his epistle. It strikes me as particularly fitting that in a letter which has earlier made a great deal of God's love for them, that Paul should here speak of believers as those who respond to God's love for them by themselves loving him, of course. And to those who do, to those of us who do, the apostle says that he, God, causes all things to cooperate, to mutually contribute to our good, to our real and eternal blessing and well-being, that is. Something very different, of course, to our present short-term pleasure and comfort, because in the end, God is working on a much larger canvas than we are, as he skillfully weaves all things together, fitting them into his perfect pattern as only God can. Perhaps the first detail to note is that Paul is certainly not claiming that all things work for our benefit by and of themselves in some mechanical or impersonal fashion. The apostle did not need to be told that it's God who operates, and as the tense which Paul uses conveys, who operates continuously. It is God who operates through that which befalls us to secure our best and our highest good. But we need to be clear what Paul had in mind when he used the word that we translate as all things, because it is clear from the use of the word elsewhere and even from the immediate context here, it does not necessarily mean all things absolutely and literally. It must always be understood in the light of the context in which it's found. The overall context here, of course, is that of providing encouragement to the saints, the believers at Rome, in the midst of suffering and trial. And as I understand it, therefore, the all things in view in my text refer to all circumstances and events which fall outside of our own control. And especially given the context, both before and after, to all forms of adversity and affliction, all forms of persecution and suffering, all forms of anguish and distress, in a word, to any trial or painful experience to which his readers were then or ever might be exposed. If I'm right, Paul is not speaking here of things we do. Certainly not of bad things we do, because make no mistake, God is not mocked. And ultimately, finally, I shall not be better off as a result of my own failings, sins, and acts of disobedience. Even if God should deign to use these for the good of others, or even for my own short-term good, rest assured, God never approves of sin. And in the final analysis, I must therefore always be the loser by it. The truth is that we're far more willing to attribute the pleasant experiences of life to the hand of God than we ever are the unpleasant experiences. But in our text, the apostle insists that all things which touch our lives, whether in themselves good or bad, that all things fall under the control of God, and as overruled by him, mutually contribute to our good. But that raises, of course, the all-important question, what does Paul mean here by good? And frankly, it's precisely here that many go astray. And in consequence, when they're faced with some great affliction or calamity, they call in question whether this seeming ironclad promise of our verse actually works out in practice. I suppose that in terms of the outcome of God's providential dealings in the life of the Christian, there can be said to be three possible dimensions to that word good. First, there's what we might call temporal, earthly good, that which contributes to our present physical enjoyment and pleasure. Second, there's spiritual good, that which is concerned not with our comfort but with our character, that which promotes our devotion to God and draws us closer to him. And then third, there is eternal good, that benefit which reaches out far beyond this present world. Come back to that distinction a little later. Paul, of all people, would have known that this principle often worked out in the present life. And this because to one so immersed in Old Testament history as he was, to him there was no shortage of examples, ranging from the classic case of Joseph in the first history book, right through to that of Esther and Mordecai in the last history book. In Joseph's case, some of us noted several years ago, there was a chain of at least 10 links stretching from Genesis 37 through to Genesis 41, which brought Joseph all the way from the home of his loving father in Canaan to the very highest position open to him in all of Egypt. And as we saw back then, Joseph's checkered experiences were each and all necessary. Not only because, as with the benefit of hindsight, Joseph came to see clearly that he was God's appointed means of saving many lives in time of severe famine, though he was, but also because he was the Lord's chosen instrument to move Jacob and his family from Canaan to Egypt, to a vast land where they could increase numerically, and how they did, to a place where they could expand and develop from a relatively small family numbering a mere 75 or so into a great nation, numbering probably in excess of 2 million. And if just one link had failed, and the descendants of Jacob had therefore never become that great nation, I tell you, the history of the world and of heaven itself would be radically different. Without question, God worked together all things, ranging from the envy of his brothers, through the lust of Potiphar's wife, to the forgetfulness of Pharaoh's butler. God worked together all of Joseph's trials and sufferings, spanning some 13 years, not only for Joseph's own good, but for the good of countless others with him, up to and including us here this very evening. But let me sound a note of caution. I said earlier that God never approves of sin. That is true. Whether in the life of Joseph or anywhere else, God is never the author of sin. Control it, use it, and overrule it for his own wise and gracious purpose? Yes. Cause and instigate it? No, never. Joan is often quoted the wise words spoken to her by her friend Steve Estes. As one day he rested his hand on a wheelchair, God permits what he hates to accomplish what he loves. Well said, Steve. There had been a time when Joseph's father would not have readily signed up to the truth of my text this evening. But there's no doubt that in later days Joseph himself would certainly have done so. But jumping from the first history book of the Old Testament to the last, we discover that if God overruled events in the days of Joseph to enable Jacob's family to develop into the nation of Israel, he overruled events in the days of Esther to save that nation, his nation, from later being exterminated. As was true of the life of Joseph, so of the life of Esther, it's possible to trace an all-important providence chain of at least 10 links. In her case, a providence chain by means of which God worked behind the scenes at every stage for the good and for the salvation of his people. Now, if anyone wants to believe that Esther just happened to win the royal beauty contest, that Mordecai just happened to uncover the assassination plot, or that the king just happened to suffer from insomnia the night before Esther denounced Haman, and then just happened to choose the right reading material, I must leave them to their folly. For my part, I am content to believe that although the Lord stayed well and truly out of sight throughout the entire book, the entire narrative, his people were never out of his sight. For to me, although God's name is not explicitly mentioned anywhere in the book, His fingerprints are all over it. I can't quarrel. The assessment of Warren Wiersbe that the Book of Esther is one of the greatest illustrations in the Bible of Romans 8:28. But the apostle had far more recent evidence that on occasions and as he pleases, God works all things, even persecution and suffering, for good during the present life. Paul had only to recall how God had brought so much good out of the martyrdom of Stephen, in whose stoning he himself had played no small part. For it was as a direct result of Stephen's death that, and I quote, "there arose a great persecution against the church which is in Jerusalem, and they were all that is except the apostles, scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria, into which vicious persecution this one time Saul of Tarsus had thrown himself heart and soul." Likely as not, he could still remember the frustration, the intense annoyance he must have felt when he had then discovered, as had the Supreme Jewish Council, that their strategy of harsh, unremitting persecution of the Jerusalem church had badly backfired both on him and on them, because, as Luke noted later, those who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. And now, as a Christian, Paul could hardly miss noting that the opposition and affliction, which almost certainly had appeared at first to be very bad for the cause of the gospel, had in fact turned out to be very good for it. Although when dictating the words of our golden text for the benefit of the believers at Rome, he had no way of knowing it, although that he would later discover that his lengthy detention in that very city would likewise turn out for the advance of the gospel. When writing later of his 2-year confinement, then with the picture in proper focus, he would be able to trace the hand of God in those events which landed him in chains there, and which enabled him to reach both to the Praetorian Guard and to the Imperial Civil Service. And as we look back on the Apostles' service for God, we can see other instances where God brought that which was good out of that which at the time seemed bad to Paul. Now take, for example, Paul's continually frustrated plans to visit Thessalonica. The apostle knew that the tempter, as he described him, was active at Thessalonica, not least in orchestrating afflictions for the young church there, and that Satan had somehow engineered his, Paul's, prolonged absence from them. And against that background, Paul not only sent Timothy to strengthen and to encourage the believers, but he wrote to assure them of his concerns. And as a result, future generations of Christians have derived untold spiritual profit from the epistle he sent. How little we would know in detail of what will happen when our Lord returns for his people. Satan certainly overreached himself that time, and God overruled for good the devil's evil scheme. But between Paul's day and ours, there have been countless other such cases of God providentially bringing good out of seeming calamity. I suspect that most, if not all of you, know nothing of a 16th century clergyman from the UK by the name of Bernard Gilpin. Now, Mr. Gilpin was a godly Oxford theologian and preacher in the then-emerging Church of England, whose life spanned the reigns of no less than five English monarchs. They didn't last very long. As a result of his Christian labours in the wilds of the north of England, he was known as the Apostle of the North, and on one occasion he was arrested to be brought up to London for trial on account of his uncompromising preaching. At the time, Mary Tudor, the Roman Catholic Queen, was on the throne. And during her reign, over 280 Protestants were executed, the majority by being burned at the stake. It was the infamous Catholic Bishop Bonner who summoned Mr. Gilpin to his trial, and who's on record as having promised that the heretic should be at a stake in a fortnight. That means 2 weeks. When informed of Bishop Bonner's intention, rather than flee into exile like any lesser mortal, Mr. Gilpin ordered his servant, William Airy, to provide a long garment for him in which he might go decently to the stake. His family later reported that on the way to London, Mr. Gilpin had an accident and broke his leg, which put a stop for a time to his journey. The persons in whose custody he was, so it's recorded, took occasion thence maliciously to retort upon him an observation that he would frequently make, that nothing happens to us but what is intended for our good, asking him whether he thought his broken leg was so intended. He replied in today's language, "I have no doubt of it." And sure enough, while he was waiting for that leg to heal, Queen Mary died. Her sister Elizabeth I, a Protestant, came to the throne, and the persecution of Protestant preachers ceased. And so, when able to travel, rather than going to London to his death, Mr. Gilpin returned safely to his home in Houghton-le-Spring near Durham in the north of England. I guess that Mr. Gilpin could relate personally to the testimony of the psalmist, "It is good for me that I have been afflicted." Well, I expect if you've not previously heard the name of Bernard Gilpin, you're probably familiar with the name of a Christian preacher who lived more or less exactly 100 years later. I speak of the Tinker of Bedford, Mr. John Bunyan. And still with the words of our text in mind, I might well ask, would this famous Baptist Puritan ever have written The Pilgrim's Progress from this world to that which is to come, had he not been imprisoned in Bedford County Jail for a considerable time? There aren't any prizes for guessing the answer to that question. Coming forward some four centuries, still with the words of our text in mind, I want to remind you of a seemingly tragic event that took place less than 60 years ago. Now, you may not be able to quote the names of all five young men who gave their lives 8th of January 56, when Warani warriors thrust their spears into them on so-called Palm Beach in the rainforest of Ecuador. You will certainly recognize the name Jim Elliot. I don't suppose that their widows or the Christian world in general regarded their deaths as a particularly good thing at the time. And yet, as we know well, their sacrifices had an impact to a greater or lesser extent on an untold number of believers since. On the 50th anniversary of the death of the five young men, the brother of one of the five, Ken Fleming, a brother of Pete, himself a missionary, he wrote, "Their sacrifice has had a life-changing effect on tens of thousands and has had some effect on millions of others." Mr. Fleming reported that during the World Conference on Evangelism at Amsterdam in 2000, Steve Saint, that's the son of another of the five, back to Steve in a minute, that Steve Saint and his father's now converted killer, Min Kay, were among the delegates from all over the world. While there, Steve and Min Kay had opportunity to ask the crowd if any of them had made life-changing decisions as a result of the sacrifice made in Ecuador in 1956. They could hardly believe it when at least 3,000 stood to their feet. And these pleas were life-changing decisions. Do you recall the apostles' words to which I referred just now? "What has happened to me has turned out for the advance of the gospel." Just 2 days before the death of the Ecuador martyrs, they'd entertained 3 Warani at their campsite, following which one of the 5, Pete Fleming, wrote in his journal, "This is a great day for the advance of the gospel." Little did Pete know. Another of the so-called 5 Ecuador martyrs was Nate Saint, the team's jungle pilot. Let me quote you the testimony of Nate Saint's son, Steve, who was just 5 years old when his father was martyred. "A few years ago," Steve wrote, "I have personally paid a high price for what happened on Palm Beach, but I've also had a front row seat as the rest of the story has been unfolding for half a century. I have seen firsthand that much good has come from it. I believe only God could have fashioned such an incredible story from such a tragic event. I could not begin to record the thousands of people who've told me that God used what happened on Palm Beach to change the course of their lives for good. If I could go back now and rewrite the script, I would not change a single scene. I've come to understand that life is too complex and much too short to let amateurs direct the story. I would rather let the master storyteller do the writing." Yeah. Many have been the times when God's people, both within and outside of Scripture, have been able to trace something of how the Lord has brought good out of seeming calamity, often for the benefit of others. But although we might choose to apply the guarantee given in Romans 8:28 in this more general way, properly speaking, our text hones in on the assurance which God gives that he works all things, works all circumstances and experiences together for good, specifically and personally for the benefit of the individual himself or herself. And the apostle certainly found this to be true in his own experience. It's generally accepted that this epistle, I wonder what that's about. Go away. Thank you. That has really caught me, that, because I thought I'd put the internet off on this machine. He's got a mind of his own. Anyone want to buy a laptop? The apostle certainly found it true in his own experience that principle sometimes and often works for the good of the individual concerned. I was saying, it's generally accepted that this particular letter was written shortly after Paul's second epistle to the Corinthians and sometime after his epistle to the Galatians. And interestingly, when writing both of those epistles, Paul had occasion to recall his experiences of many years before, experiences which were anything but pleasant at the time, but in which, as he now looked back on them, he could clearly trace God's hand at work. In his letter to the Galatians, he had occasion to refer to a visit which he paid to Jerusalem about 3 years after his conversion, that far back. His purpose in going was to see the apostles, and Peter in particular. Initially, he encountered a little difficulty when he attempted to join himself to the disciples, and this for the simple reason that he'd spent the 3 years since his conversion in Damascus and Arabia, and consequently the saints at Jerusalem still knew of him only as a persecutor and an enemy. They were therefore, and I don't blame them, all afraid of him. Thanks, however, to the commendation the good offices of Barnabas, the church received Paul. The apostles' time at Jerusalem was spent in evangelism, as well as in conference with Peter. But his dispute with the Hellenists, these are Greek-speaking Jews of the kind that saw Stephen off, Paul must have felt that. His dispute with the Hellenists soon landed him in hot water. And for his own safety, the Christians sent him off to Tarsus via Caesarea. Now, personally, I suspect there may well have been a measure of reluctance on Paul's part to leave. I've got in mind some things that happened in the book of Acts. Never mind. Certainly, it must have been a great disappointment to this apostle to curtail his activities at Jerusalem and terminate his conference with Peter after only 2 weeks, or a fortnight if you're in the UK. But when Paul wrote Galatians, he's looking back on the events of Acts 9. His present problem was to establish beyond dispute that his apostleship was entirely independent of Jerusalem. And in demonstrating that he was an apostle, not from men nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father, he was able to point out not only that the Jerusalem apostles recognized his independent apostleship, and that so far was he from being an appointee of Peter, that on one occasion he'd actually rebuked Peter publicly, but he was able to point out that for the first 17 years of his ministry, he'd visited Jerusalem only once, and then for no more than 15 days. The fact that the Lord had permitted Paul to see Peter for little more than 2 weeks formed an invaluable part of that argument. And Paul could now see that what, on account of the fierce opposition of the Hellenists, had been a great disappointment to him at the time, had indeed been worked by God for his good. In his second letter to the Corinthians, Paul had occasion to refer to his thorn in the flesh and the reason for it. Chapter 12 of his letter, the apostle had felt compelled to raise the subject of visions and revelations because it seems that one of the very serious charges leveled against Paul at Corinth was that he never had any ecstasies or visions, and he knew that the Corinthians, who'd rather lost their head over such things, would have regarded that as important. He felt constrained, therefore, to refer to an experience he'd had over 14 years before, when he had been caught up into paradise. It was following this experience that he had been afflicted with a thorn in the flesh, which he had reason to attribute to the malice of Satan. Now clearly this thorn was something physical, it was painful, it was humiliating, and above all else, it was regarded by Paul as interfering with his service for the Lord. He therefore prayed about it 3 times, specifically asking the Lord to remove it. In response, the Lord had granted Paul 2 things. First, he gave him his sufficient grace. Ah, yes. The Lord dealt with the problem, though not in the way Paul had hoped. He had asked, in effect, that the Lord would remove the burden from off his back, please. Instead, the Lord undertook to strengthen the back which bore the burden. Second, he gave Paul an explanation. The Lord told Paul why he refused to remove the thorn. Paul's underlying concern had been with his future usefulness for the Lord. And the Lord taught him that his thorn, a source of his weakness, was essential if he was ever to remain a vessel useful to his heavenly master. For there was a very real danger that on account of those breathtaking revelations he'd received, the apostle, a converted Pharisee, remember, that he would become lifted as high in conceit and pride as ever he'd been in his visions. The thorn would therefore serve to keep him humble and therefore usable. And as Paul had looked back in 2 Corinthians 12, over 14 years of later apostolic ministry, he realized that the Lord's way was indeed best, and that throughout he, the Lord, had been working all things together for his good. Yeah. But having said all this, and you'll accept, I hope, that what I've said is reasonably soundly based in scripture and in history, but having said all this, we have to recognize that first and foremost, our verse is not speaking about any good in this present life at all, about any good which in his kind providence God may choose to bring out of seemingly adverse circumstances or experiences, whether that good be physical or spiritual. It's clear from the context that what Paul has principally in mind is our ultimate and eternal good in a far grander world than this is, namely the achieving of God's long-term purpose for us, that we should be conformed to the image of his Son and should be glorified. That is the good which God has in view when he orchestrates all things, all events in our lives. It's not our comfort, it's not our wealth, it's not our health in the here and now. It is our conformity to a glorified Christ in heaven. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that all things, that all circumstances and affairs in the lives of God's people do not always work together for good in this world. Nor has that ever been true. The writer to the Hebrews knew it well, made the point clearly when listing out some of the past exploits and achievements of faith in his chapter 11. Having spoken of some of the wonderful triumphs of faith, of those who through faith subdued kingdoms, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, of women who received back their dead by resurrection. He then added, but others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection, and others underwent trial of mockings and scourgings, yes, and of chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, were tempted, were slain with the sword, and so on. Be hard to miss that whereas through faith some of God's people escaped the edge of the sword, others, equally through faith, were slain with the sword. And in New Testament days, we have only to think of Acts chapter 12, the apostles Peter and James. Neither can we miss the writer's reference to another, to a better world, that they might obtain a better resurrection, better that is, than the cases of resurrection in the days of Elijah and Elisha, to which he has just referred, in that the return to life of the two sons in view then were only temporary. They were still mortal, and would therefore die again later. They were, if you like, only out on parole. They were required to report back to death again in due course. But the better resurrection, for which the tortured and suffering saints looked, will be no short-term release, for they, as we, if we die, will be raised incorruptible, never to die again. Truly then, as the apostle expressed it just a handful of verses before my text, the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. But alas for me, I'm spiritually short-sighted. I need to remind myself constantly that much as I wish it did, my text for this evening does not commit God to make me happy, contented and successful down here. It commits him rather to pattern me after the image of his Son. And what a thought that is, that according to the opening section of our chapter, God's own Son should be sent in the likeness of sinful flesh. And this, that according to the closing section of the chapter, we sinners might one day be changed into his likeness, that one day we should bear the image of him who is heavenly. Whenever we face adversity and trial, we rest on God's promise that he will work it out for good in the end. And if we find that it has not worked out for good, then we must conclude this is only because it's not yet the end. And we're in no position to judge the goodness of God's working until his program's finished. Meantime, though we cannot comprehend the mystery of his dealings with us, we can surely rest in the assurance that Jesus gave Simon Peter when he prepared to wash his feet in the so-called upper room. You do not fully grasp what I am doing now, but afterward you will understand. And those words, afterward you will understand, remind me of something I read some time ago about the late Dr. E.C. Caldwell. He was then professor of New Testament at a theological seminary in the U.S. Dr. Caldwell had just completed his lecture for the day and informed his students of their assignment. Tomorrow, he concluded, I will be teaching on the 8th chapter of Romans. So tonight, as you study this chapter, I want you to pay close attention to verse 28. All things work together for good to them that love God. He paused and added, one final word before I dismiss you. Whatever happens in all the years to come, remember, Romans 8:28 will always hold true. Later that day, Dr. Caldwell and his wife were driving their car over a railroad crossing, oblivious to the fact that a freight train was approaching the crossing. The train plowed into the car, killing Mrs. Caldwell instantly. Severely injured, Dr. Caldwell was rushed by ambulance to the hospital. He survived, but his injuries left him permanently handicapped. Months later, he returned to the classroom. Gripping his cane, he stood before the class. Not a sound could be heard. They remembered his last words about Romans 8:28. Looking into the faces of his students, he said, Romans 8:28 still holds true. One day, we shall see God's good, even in this. Yes, Dr. Caldwell, one day. And that will be the ultimate happy ending, when our God will wipe away every tear. And in that context, I can't but think of the third verse of George Matheson's masterly hymn, O love that wilt not let me go. O joy that seekest me through pain, I cannot close my heart to thee. I trace the rainbow through the rain and feel the promise is not vain, that morn shall tearless be. We can only imagine how this evening's text, what it must have meant to the believers in Rome, when some 7 years down the road, they faced the full brunt of Nero's ruthless persecution. And what a joy it is for us to know this evening that our highest good is God's sieve, which he uses when permitting these all things to enter our lives, that nothing but nothing happens to us outside of his control, that he is never taken by surprise. He never makes mistakes. And that whatever appearances may suggest to the contrary, God's kind providence will always say to us, in the words of the prophet Balaam, Behold, I have received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot reverse it. Yes, indeed. We know that to those who love God, he works all things together for good to those who are called according to his purpose. God willing, we'll cover the remaining verses of the chapter next Wednesday, shall we pray.